I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with Frances Moore LaPay, from Diet for a Small Planet to a New Living Democracy for what she calls a world gone mad. But first, President Bush is once again urging House Democrats not to stand in the way of an intelligence bill that would extend warrantless domestic wiretapping during terrorism investigations and give telecommunications companies who help the government immunity from prosecution.
It's in our national interest because we want to know who's calling who. From overseas into America, we need to know in order to protect the people. It was legal.
Bush also said the country is not in recession, though he admitted that the country is facing economic woes, and he called for more funding and support for the war in Iraq. Well, Joe Williams is the Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's covering the story. Joe, let's start with the domestic surveillance bill, the Protect America Act that's been held up in the House. This has been an ongoing battle. Was there anything new today?
Not much new. The president basically is trying to put more pressure on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to allow a vote on the House's version of this anti-terror bill, which would basically exempt lawsuits, telecom companies from being sued if a consumer had been found to have their rights violated by this surveillance act.
And critics and Democrats in particular are pushing back, saying that the current law, which did expire, had a built-in extension. There's also the FISA courts where investigators can go and get warrants. What is the sticking point of granting the telecommunications companies immunity? I mean, is it just the fact that one side feels that citizens could then sue?
Well, the president says that if the telecom companies aren't exempt, they'll be more reluctant to help the government in this surveillance, while the House leaders or House Democratic leadership believes that consumers have a right to ask for redress should their rights have been found to be violated, because this terror operation basically sweeps up all kinds of information and then sort of sifts through it to figure out what might be relevant to the fight against terrorism. And in that sense, it's kind of indiscriminate as to who gets listened to, and consumers may not necessarily know that their rights have been violated until after the fact.
Well, the president, as we said, also talked about Iraq. He criticized his political opponents, saying it seems no matter what happens in Iraq, opponents say retreat. He described what sounded like a fairly rosy situation, politicians passing laws, said the best course of action would be to fund our troops. Now, this follows Republicans this week stunning Democrats by calling for a public debate on the funding issue. In the past, they'd been reluctant to talk about what they saw as a failed regurgitation of the failures in Iraq. And reports are now saying they see the war as a plus for the Republican Party in the November elections. Were you picking up that positiveness from the president?
Yes. He's always been pretty bullish on the war. And since the violence has been reduced in the last year and a half, he's been especially forthcoming about talking about what a success Iraq is. Basically, it's also an attempt to help John McCain, who is staking a large portion of his presidential bid on success in Iraq and the success of the surge. However, the violence, a lot of critics say on closer inspection, is down simply because a lot of the leaders over there, including Muqtada al-Sadr, have pledged to cease hostilities and give the government some time to get its act together, and there isn't necessarily a lot of evidence that the government is doing that. Things are still fairly close to where they were a year ago. There has not been a lot of drastic movement by the government, but the violence has been down, and that's something that American leaders and American military leaders and the president are all pointing to as signs of success.
Right. Well, and moving to the economy, when asked what Americans would do if gas prices rose to $4 a gallon, the president said, "What did you say? I hadn't heard that. That's interesting." Did he seem out of touch in that moment, or describe that moment?
Well, I think basically he was surprised by the fact that anyone was considering $4 gas. I know on the West Coast, gas is creeping up towards $4, and it's typically always a lot higher in the West than it is in the East. The president was surprised by the notion that gas could reach $4 a gallon, it seemed. And it goes against his sort of picture that the economy is doing okay. It's not doing well, but it's doing okay, and that gas prices surging towards $4 a gallon can cause more worry and more concern. He also mentioned that part of the reason or one solution that he has to rising gas prices is to build refineries on abandoned military bases, which is something that was relatively new. That really hasn't been discussed all that much publicly.
Joe Williams, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
To our conversation today. In the 1970s, when she was in her 20s, Frances Moore LePay wrote what would become a bestseller, Diet for a Small Planet. In it, she argued that eating low on the food chain, a radical thought for meat-loving Americans, was as nutritious as eating a steak and was also better for the world's health. Well, millions of people made that book their Bible, but apparently Frances now feels the world still has a health problem. Her new book is titled Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. In it, she says citizens need to take not just their food, but the democratic process into their own hands, take it away from people who are buying access to corridors of power. In Diet, Frances, who joins us now in the studio, you talked about how you discovered that American food systems created scarcity, and our democratic system is now creating economic disparity. Creating scarcity?
Because we live in a world where we turn over our fate to a market, but not any kind of market, what I call a one-rule market.
What does that mean?
Highest return to existing wealth, those who own shares. 80% of the people live in countries where inequality is increasing, concentration of wealth is increasing, and so the people who need the food don't have the money, the market demand power, to move the food producing resources in their direction. So what happens? Over a third of the world's grain goes to feed livestock, mm-hmm. and most of the world's soy goes to feed livestock, which then return to us only a tiny fraction. We say we fear scarcity, but by giving over our fate to this definition of a market, we actually end up creating the poverty that then drives economy into inefficiency.
And that's where the parallel is, because you were talking about food in A Diet for a Small Planet. Now you're talking about wealth and, you know, saying that huge wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few, an increase of 81% in the hands of the wealthiest 5% in America in the last 20 years. And you say Americans can do more than they think. They think they're powerless about these inequalities or about global warming. Because they have a wrong-headed view of democracy. There's an acceptance of a thin democracy as opposed to a real democracy. What's a thin democracy?
Well, you just nailed it. The only problem we really have to worry about in the world is our own feeling of powerlessness, because we know the answers. I grew up in the 50s in Texas thinking that democracy, well, it was about elections plus a market economy and we've got democracy. There's nothing really for me to do. It's
except
all finished
shop.
And done. Shop and maybe vote, but that's not even required, right? Yeah. So it didn't dawn on me until much later for democracy to work. It can't be just these structures that concentrate power. It has to become a living democracy, a way of life, not just political life, but economic life and education. This is not a pipe dream, Robin. This is happening. I just want to make that clear. This book, Getting a Grip, is a report on what I've had the privilege of seeing emerge. And I love to call it living democracy because it is ever-evolving. It's what we create.
Well, let's get to some examples. For instance, we said that there's a sense of someone in a thin democracy thinking that the enemy is they, some sort of evildoer outside of our own, you know, capacity to change things. Then you met Jack Shipley, who's a part-time rancher from Grants Pass, Oregon, head of the Applegate Partnership. He brought loggers and environmentalists together in a watershed protection plan, in part by an attitude that was expressed in a button that he wore. What did the button say?
The button said, "They" with a slash through it. In other words, the no sign. There is no they. Jack's example is an example of people crossing the barriers to those so that the loggers, the environmentalists were sitting down, getting to know one another and working something out that met their basic needs as human beings.
You were just saying that in a thin democracy, it's the free market along with government and corporate executives that determine what goes on. And, you know, we just go out and shop. In a real living, thriving democracy, citizens use their voices to shape public choices. And you're not talking just about, you know, making sure that you go to city council meetings, although I'm sure you'd be for that. Explain, for instance, what you saw in Brazil, the participatory budget process. What is that?
Well, participatory budgeting is this notion of actual direct citizen deliberation. In other words, we let go of this notion that we're just simply these selfish little materialists out to get our stuff. And we really have confidence that there are needs in us, needs for fairness and connection with our neighbors. So we can sit down, as they do in now hundreds of Brazilian cities, and the citizens have a direct say over a huge portion of the local budget. Money that had been going just to pave the roads of the already wealthy neighborhoods are now going to create clinics and schools in the poor barrios. And corruption has been greatly reduced. So this is what I think a living democracy is, getting money out of the decision-making. In other words, translated into the U.S., it would mean public financing of all elections, getting money out, getting citizens' voices directly in.
So what are some of the things that they have voted for?
Well, when I was there, I saw this brand new community center where they were performing, teenagers were dancing traditional dances for us, and then there was a new clinic they were telling me about, a new school, and I said, how did you afford this? You know, it's one thing, you know, to have better use of public funds, but it seemed like this is a lot of money. And they said, well, part of the answer is that there was less graft because there were more eyes, citizens' direct eyes on the process, so there was more money. And now I believe the figure is that in these cities where there is participatory budgeting, that for every administrative dollar spent, maybe 10, 20 years ago, it resulted in $3 of services. And now for every administrative dollar spent, there is $7 worth of services that are actually benefiting the community. So that shows you the increased efficiency when you have engaged citizens.
You met one of these citizens, a woman who's running this, and she seemed to have the same kind of almost Shazam and surprise that you had in the 70s, with your like light bulb going off.
Adriana Ranha, who in 1993, she was part of a city administration in Belo Horizonte, which is the fourth largest city in Brazil. And she and her other officials who were elected decided that food, essential to life, was a human right in their city. They declared it a right of citizenship. They brought together, instead of just lengthening soup lines, right, and saying, okay, everybody has a right to eat, they brought together all kinds of different groups, from business to farmers to hospitals and other institutions that feed people and religious groups, etc., and they came up with dozens and dozens of innovations to make good, healthy, organic food available even to the poorest in the city, like the little plots of city-owned land. They made that available to small farmers to come in and sell if they keep their food in the reach of the poorest people in the barrios. I talked to her about this, and she told me that this accounted for 1% of the city budget. And with that, within a decade, they had reduced infant mortality, which is the best measure of hunger, reduced infant mortality in the city by 56%. There was one moment when she started to tear up as I asked her a question. So I interrupted the interpreter to explain to me what she was saying. And what she had said is, she said, what I knew when we started this is that we were very out of step with the direction of the rest of the world that said, oh, just the market magic is going to do it all. And I said, no, that there was a role for government to work with citizens. So I knew how out of step we were. I knew how much hunger there is in the world. But what I didn't know, and what upsets me so, is how easy it is to end it. I will remember that forever, because we know how to do it, Robin. If we can break free of the stranglehold, what I call the straitjacket here, of these false ideas.
Frances Moore LePay, we'll be back with more from her, and later, a college loan alert. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from author and activist Frances Moore LePay. Her new book is Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. In Moore's 1970s bestseller, Diet for a Small Planet, she wrote about Americans taking more control of their food. In Getting a Grip, she says Americans should take more control of the democratic process. And Frances, before the break, you said a living democracy gets corporate money out of the decision-making, the policy process. And you say public financing of all elections in the U.S. is a major part of this. Make that case.
Democracy doesn't happen, or a democratic market is impossible that serves us all, unless we keep values boundaries around it. And that means keeping money out of the system so that our citizens' voices can be in. I think this is the best-kept secret in America, that we know how to get money out. It's working in two states, in Arizona and in Maine. There is voluntary public financing. It's going to be starting in Connecticut. And to take it national, to have all federal contests run with public financing would cost just $6 for each American.
When you mention Maine and Arizona, in Arizona, 9 of 11 state offices are held by candidates who qualified for public money by taking very little private money. I mean, the demand is that we want clean candidates. You also write about producer responsibility laws in Maine. Laws have been passed so that corporations who make things are responsible for that thing from beginning to end, making sure that it's recycled or doesn't pollute the environment. You talk about tax shifting, which is happening in many European countries. What is that?
If you want to do something good for the environment, you shift taxes so that fossil fuels are taxed, but less tax on family income. And so they've shifted over $1,000 equivalent from families from income to their fossil fuel use. So you put downward incentive, if you will, on people who use fossil fuels, but you don't end up taxing people more heavily. That is the kind of thing that we can do as we reclaim our political process. And Maine, you mentioned, is such a good example because 80% of the legislators there are now people who've run clean, that is, without private big money behind them. And so they were able to pass really a model piece of legislation that said, if you're a corporation that produces, say, a computer monitor, you are responsible for the entire life cycle. And the beauty of it is that it changes the logic of the market. So that company now has the incentive to make more easily recyclable products and with less toxics in them. As I talked to people in Maine about the passage of that particular bill, they said most of the big electronics companies came in and fought against this bill, but it passed anyway, because the legislators knew that they hadn't been relying on these corporations to help them get in office to begin with.
Yes. You give so many examples of people, redefining what power means, it being inclusive instead of corrupting or divisive. There's the story of Chattanooga, Tennessee, 50 citizens who got together and did something called visioning, really decide, just meeting on a monthly basis to decide how to get rid of the pollution in the city, and they just completely revamped the city. You talk about old school democracy being drawing up a manifesto and selling it, this new democracy that you're talking about, real democracy, being about listening. Tell us briefly about Professor Peter Elbow. He's right here at the University of Massachusetts. He has something called the believing game. What is that?
Well, it's a very basic notion that in our culture, we are taught constantly to think critically, which is good, to constantly poke holes in things. But he suggests that we practice the game of suspending disbelief and exploring the positives before we disregard it. The most effective citizen organizations in the country are those who are perfecting the art of listening in one-on-one sessions. Now there are millions of Americans, at least 3 million Americans, involved through their congregations in these sorts of approaches where people learn to sit in one another's homes, really listen. And even if they don't call it the believing game, they are not being critical of one another, but just absorbing and listening, and out of that coming powerful action. One of my favorite examples of living democracy and building human relationships and truly listening, it's a story of something called the Listening Project in North Carolina, where they go door to door instead of just having a check-off, okay, what is your concern? They sit with their neighbors. They don't even have a check-off list, but they listen. And in this one case, they tell the story of talking to a middle-aged white man, and right off the bat, he said, oh, yeah, the problem is those African-American kids who are so loud and boisterous and, on the streets, and that's the problem. And they just listened. They didn't mark him down as a racist. And by the end of this conversation and just listening, he said, it's really that there are not enough job opportunities. There are not enough recreational opportunities. And I want to get behind that. I really want to be part of that.
But as you probably know, Frances Moore LePay, this can sound like left-leaning, progressive, wishful thinking. As I read, you tell Americans how to get their concerns to the forefront. Do you mean for these same techniques that you write about to be used by right-leaning conservatives for whom perhaps abortion is the primary concern?
Absolutely. And I think where conservatives, real conservatives, and real progressives come together is a common suspicion of concentrated power, And Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1938 said, quote, "The liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth of private power to the point that it is stronger than the democratic state itself, That, in its essence, is fascism. And so I think this message of the dispersion of power, the infusion of citizen voices into the system, removing money from the system, this is not a partisan question. 90% of Americans think that money has too much sway in Washington or are outraged by this figure of 61-1, you know, that citizens' representatives are outnumbered by lobbyists 61-1. So I think this has has legs, as they say, among conservatives, real conservatives, and progressives. There's this common sense that our common sense will get us there, and that's what Living Democracy says.
Frances Moore LePay, author, oh my gosh, in the 1970s of Diet for a Small Planet, her new book, Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. Frances, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Montana's Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer. He's been called the coal cowboy. He wants to build more coal-fired power plants with the technology he says would reduce greenhouse gases. Well, we'll hear from the governor, but also get a reality check on his plans from an energy expert. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, college students, listen up. The subprime mortgage crisis is doing in student loans, but breathe. We have some advice. That's after the news, Here and Now. As predicted, the subprime mortgage market collapse is sending shockwaves through other parts of the economy, and now it's wreaking havoc on the student loan market. Yesterday, another state agency announced that it will no longer offer federally guaranteed student loans. The Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, one of the country's largest student loan operations, now joins a handful of other state loan agencies that are cutting back or cutting out student loans. We're hearing anecdotally that college CFOs are planning on greatly expanding their acceptance roles in the fall, fearful that so many of those accepted students won't get financing, and even the nation's largest student loan company, Sallie Mae, has tightened loan standards. Well, why is this happening, and what to do about it? Gail Marks-Jarvis is a personal finance columnist at the Chicago Tribune. Gail, welcome.
Good to be here.
And remind us of the connections. Why is there less money for student loans because mortgages have failed?
This seems so strange to people because they seem like very, very different types of loans, and they are, except they're created in the same way.
Well, we know, for instance, that people package mortgage loans and then they in turn sell them to other people who want to invest in them in the hopes of making some money, and that lenders package student loans together into securities to sell, and people haven't been buying them.
People are afraid to buy the packages of mortgages, and they're afraid to buy the packages of student loans. In effect, what you have out there is a buying strike by investors. And if investors will not buy the packages of student loans, money dries up. And that could create a very nasty problem this fall.
Well, it's sort of a vicious cycle because, as you're saying, investors aren't buying these packages of student loans, which, of course, give the people who make the loans the money to give the loans. And we understand that parents have been increasingly using their home equity lines to pay for their student college loans. And so if those equity lines and those mortgages are failing and they're losing their homes, they don't have their homes to help them pay for the student loans. So this is why investors are afraid to buy the loans, because they're afraid that people are going to default on them.
That's exactly the case. The other thing is that last fall, Congress made changes so that student lenders would get a smaller profit than they've been getting. So that made some companies question the business. Then, when the credit crisis started and these lenders had trouble borrowing money themselves at good interest rates, they had their profits basically slashed. In fact, they just couldn't provide the loans at enough profit for them to stay in business.
Well, let's remind ourselves, the college loan market, we understand, has three parts. There's the federal government, which gives out loans directly to schools, which in turn make loans. And the federal government also allows for-profit companies to make loans with some government restrictions. And then there's the completely private loan market, where you just go to a bank and try to get a loan at rates that they set. Are all of these impacted?
Any kind of lender who wants to package up loans and sell those loans to investors is affected. If you think about the federal rules on the lowest cost student loans, we know them as Stafford loans, Right now, they carry a 6.8% interest rate.
And the government requires that if companies give out the Stafford loans, they have to adhere to that low rate.
That's correct. If you're a freshman in college, the most you can borrow Stafford loans is $3,500 a year as a freshman. That goes up when you're a junior to $5,500 a year. But that's nothing compared to college costs now. Consequently, some states have stepped forward, and they've said, we're going to provide some lower interest loans, too. These are called private loans, but they're still lower interest loans than you would probably get if you went to a bank. So, for example, in the case of Minnesota, which provides low interest student loans right now, you can get about a 7% interest rate. If you went to a bank, you might have to pay about 12% or even as high as 19%. But even there, there's a catch. If you go to a bank and you seek a private loan, they're going to look at your credit score. And so if your credit's not really good, your chance of qualifying to get a low-interest loan goes down. This could be especially painful for low-income students. In addition, some of the colleges that already are having trouble getting loans are some of the vocational types of colleges. And sometimes lower-income people turn to those kinds of colleges, and they're the ones that have been hit right away.
Well, the government is saying that if private companies do pull back on making these student loans, especially these government-backed Stafford loans, that the government will take on more of them. But how much can the government do?
Well, the government hasn't said how much they can do. But people that are in the lending business, for example, I've talked to some people that work for the state of Illinois that are involved in providing low-interest loans for students, and they're very concerned because they realize that the government cannot pick up the full slack. I mean, we're talking about them having to do a 400% increase in loans, which they couldn't possibly do. The point is that right now, no one is sure just how long the credit crisis might last. And so if this is resolved in a few months, the government won't have the problem. But if it's not resolved quickly, then there could be major problems. And one thing people should know about, if they're planning to go to college in the fall and they've already been in college, they've already applied for their student loans for next year. And they maybe think that those loans are on the way. Those students have to check right now with their lender and make sure that the loan that they thought they were going to get is still going to be there for them, because overnight some lenders have been going out of business and they've had applications that students thought were being processed, and those applications are not being processed. I talked to one the other day in Florida. They had about 240 applications that they were working on, and they went out of business. They went out of business so quickly they didn't even notify the families that they weren't finishing the applications on the loans. So what students have to do is this. They have to go to their financial aid office at college, and they have to say, I think I have a student loan lined up. Do I?
A couple last tips we've been reading. Some private banks have been, you know, seeing the problem with student loans, so they're trying to get in on some of the business by offering better deals than they might have in the past. So check them out. And also get a cosigner if you're a student, someone to help you get a better credit rating.
Well, that's a two-edged sword, because a student can get a better interest rate if a parent with good credit will co-sign with them. But I've also talked to parents over the years that really got hurt that way. The student finishes college, and if that person who's now out in the workplace stops paying the loan, the parent's credit score gets hurt.
So that's something to look out for. Gail Marks Jarvis, personal finance columnist at the Chicago Tribune. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as always, we want to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can always give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And by the way, we're working on a story about Washington's plans to maybe bail out banks in the wake of the mortgage crisis. Some people don't believe Wall Street deserves it, but if it helps you get a student loan, you may think differently. You're listening to Here and Now. Baseball's spring training is underway, but instead of talk of steals and strike zones, steroids dominate the headlines once again. Here to talk about that ongoing saga and the rest of the week in sports, which had a sad loss that we want to talk about, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Welcome, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, so what an awkward moment this must have been. Roger Clemens pitching to minor leaguers at the Houston Astros training camp in Florida when news broke that Congress wants the Justice Department to launch this perjury investigation into him and not his accuser.
Right. Congress has decided whom they believe in the he said, they said controversy that we have spoken about before. And unfortunately, it's not Roger Clemens, unfortunately for Roger Clemens. Mm-hmm. And news broke today that the Astros, who have had given Clemens a 10-year personal service contract, which would kick in at the point that he actually formally retires, have now said, well, we're not so sure about this 10-year mm-hmm. personal services contract. It depends on what happens next with this investigation.
Huh. And we should remind ourselves, his accuser is Brian McNamee, the former New York Yankees trainer who claims that he injected Clemens with steroids.
Well, rather former personal trainer to Roger Clemens, not only with the Yankees but also with the Blue Jays. He kind of followed Clemens wherever
right.
he went for
right.
some period of time.
So as you said, Congress has decided who they believe. Okay, turning to pro basketball. Last night against the Boston Celtics, Cleveland Cavaliers all-star LeBron James sprained his ankle, limps off the court, returns, scores 26 points. At 23 years and 59 days, everyone counting, he's now the youngest player in NBA history to reach the milestone 10,000-point mark. He could catch Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Well, he certainly could. Of course, he had an advantage over Kareem, and that is that LeBron didn't waste any time in college. He went right from high school to
sure.
the NBA, so
Does
he got an earlier
in?
Start.
Do they
they're just talking about age at this point. And in fact, Kareem and several other players got to 10,000 points in fewer games than LeBron James. It's a little bit hard to predict this sort of thing, of course, because number one, you don't know whether he'll be injury-free. You don't know how many years he'll decide to play. You don't know what kind of teammates will surround him over the next decade or so. The one thing we can say, I think, with absolute certainty is, given the way salaries have escalated, LeBron will make more money than any of those other guys, Kareem included.
Right, and he's a pleasure to watch.
He is indeed.
Well, finally, we want to take some time today to remember a great sports writer and author who also happened to be a friend of yours. W.C. Bill Hines died yesterday in Bennington, Vermont. He was 93. Tell us about his life.
Well, Bill Hines has been credited legitimately, I think, with teaching people how beautiful sports writing can be. And when I say sports writing, I say great writing that happens to be set in sports. Bill's own personal favorite sport to write about, I think, was boxing. He was also a correspondent, a newspaper correspondent during the Second World War, and wrote brilliantly understated dispatches at that point as well. Wrote a great novel called The Professional, which Ernest Hemingway, Bill's editor, cabled Hemingway in Cuba, sent the novel, and Hemingway sent a telegram back saying, it's not only the best book that I've ever read set in boxing, it's a damn fine novel in its own right. Mm-hmm. And Bill still had the telegram, of course, years later. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories about Bill is Damon Runyon at the end of his life. Couldn't finish an assignment that he had, and his editor said, well, who do I get to finish this assignment? Runyon was suffering from throat cancer. He couldn't speak, and he wrote on a cocktail napkin, W.C. Hines is very good, and he underlined very good three times. Hmm. So you got some real heavyweights endorsing this guy. We're fortunate enough to have a few seconds of Bill's voice. He's reading from a story titled Brownsville Bum, a story of Bummy Davis, who was a boxer who was hated by a lot of people because when he got angry in the ring, he would hit his opponent low. But Bummy's life ended when he took on three gunmen who were trying to rob a bar with only his fists. And this is Bill reading the first few lines of that story.
It's a funny thing about people. People will hate a guy all his life for what he is. But the minute he dies for it, they make him out a hero, and they go around saying that maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all, because he sure was willing to go the distance for whatever he believed in or whatever he was.
W.C. Bill Hines, who died yesterday in Vermont at 93, and you know, you listed his accomplishments, also co-wrote MASH, the book.
Absolutely.
Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game, thanks so much for letting us remember him.
Thank you, Robin.
And back with remembering another great man, Johnny Mercer, here and now. The late Johnny Mercer remains one of popular music's preeminent lyricists. He wrote poignantly and poetically about Moon River, the glowworm, and the barrooms. Although in one of his celebrated lyrics, Mercer advised us to accentuate the positive, he had a darker side, and here now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs explains.
What is the subject of many, if not most, popular songs? Love, of course. But the subject of alcohol has also fueled the mills of songwriters for time immemorial. Johnny Mercer was born in 1909 and died in 1976. This favorite son of Savannah, Georgia, knew more than a thing or two about saloon society. It was with Henry Mancini that Mercer won the last of his four Academy Awards for the song The Days of Wine and Roses from 1962. This is the second in what we'll call Mercer's Saloon Song Trilogy. The first is from 1943 with music by Harold Arlen. It was introduced by Fred Astaire in a long-forgotten movie musical, The Sky's the Limit, but everyone knows this confessional number. It contains one of the most unforgettable opening lines ever set to a melody. Not only are we all familiar with this one, but who in the world doesn't know its signature interpreter?
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me.
Nobody else but Sinatra. That's the definitive recording of One for My Baby and One More for the Road, with Sinatra's voice conveying for all time the loneliness of the solitary drinker after the bar is closed. Johnny Mercer knew that man sitting on a bar stool. He knew that woman staring into the bottom of a highball glass. For Johnny Mercer himself was a drinker, and not a good one. Let's leave it at that. Drinking Again is the third, final, and least known installment of Mercer's Saloon Song Trilogy. Like Days of Wine and Roses, it was copyrighted in 1962. Mercer's collaborator on Drinking Again was Doris Tauber, best known for having co-written the Billie Holiday favorite Them Their Eyes back in 1933. While Them Their Eyes is all bouncy insouciance, Drinking Again is dire, a tale not only of boozy, forced late-night bonhomie, but of lost love, with no hope of it ever being regained. Tauber's music is just the kind that the solitary drinker in One for My Baby asks the barkeep to play on the jukebox. Easy and sad.
That's why I'm drinking again and thinking of when you loved me.
Dinah Washington, the Queen of the Blues, recorded Drinking Again in 1962. Just before Christmas 1963, she died, at age 39, from an accidental overdose of barbiturates mixed with alcohol. Hers was the first version of Drinking Again that I ever heard, and though she's down, she's hardly maudlin. Listen to her delivery and attitude. Sure, there's tenderness, but she's tough as nails, despite being well into her cups. As Dinah Washington was about to exit the stage, there was a new queen in waiting. Aretha Franklin was not quite 22 years old early in 1964 when, about 2 months after Washington's death, Franklin recorded a tribute album featuring songs associated with Dinah. One of those tunes was Drinking Again. That gospel-fired, almost operatic first note, with doleful organ and jazz trumpet obbligato in the background, was a most audacious way of announcing that Aretha was setting them up and drinking them down. How many of us, at her age, could have convincingly put across the notion of trying to get home with nothing but a memory? Hear how the future Queen of Soul trudges wearily out of the tavern, alone again.
And just a memory.
We now move forward to 1968 and across the Atlantic Ocean. In London, one of the hottest blues rock bands of the moment was the Jeff Beck Group, led by the explosive guitarist. The lead singer was a gravel-voiced, Sam Cooke-inspired dandy called Rod Stewart, who was then 23. For some reason, the Beck Group were quoted drinking again. And for whatever reason, they retitled it as I've Been Drinking, though they credited Mercer and Tauber as co-composers.
So I know I can borrow a snow. Or sit here all night long and tell a joke.
We pick up the performance at the bridge following a brief buzz-toned guitar solo. Here, the producer, Mickey Most, comes up with a smart move. He adds a distant, wordless vocal by Madeline Bell and adds echo to Stewart's voice, thus giving this drinking again a more tangible, if ghostly, hook to the past. For what, after all, is this song, and so many others like it, ultimately about, but a desire to change the past? Or as Jay Gatsby said plaintively in The Great Gatsby, can't repeat the past? Why, of course you can.
I wish that you were right by my side.
One wonders what Johnny Mercer, no fan of rock and roll, would have made of Rod Stewart's rendering of his lyric. Funny thing is, 35 years later, Stewart staged a major comeback by reinventing himself as a champion of the Great American Songbook. But when we think of the Great American Songbook and its foremost male interpreters, we must go to Mr. Sinatra. In 1967, the master had a go at drinking again. While Sinatra no longer sounded like he did in the mid-1950s, when he was in his absolute prime, he was still in very good voice. Plus, he was a superb actor in song. Sinatra sings Drinking Again as if he's just soused enough, but he has no glow. On the other side of 50, he's seen it all. A little slurry, he attempts none too successfully to conceal his many regrets. The exquisite arrangement is by Klaus Ogerman.
Oh, yeah, I'm drinking again. It's always the same. That same old story. After the kicks, there's little old mixed up me.
The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there, wrote the British novelist L.P. Hartley. I'm drinking again and thinking of when you loved me, wrote Johnny Mercer. Bottoms up.
Here and now's James Isaacs with his reflections on Johnny Mercer's Saloon Song Trilogy. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.